On September 18, 2020, the world lost an extraordinary person with a brilliant mind and a caring heart. A trailblazer who will be remembered as one of the most influential advocates for equality in the history of our country. I'm talking, of course, about Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who dedicated her life to widening the circle of opportunity and opening doors for countless others who came after her, and who became a pop culture sensation, the notorious RBG in the process. I've often said that nominating Justice Ginsburg to the Supreme Court was perhaps the best decision I made as president. I'll never forget the first time we met, when I invited her to the White House for an interview as I weighed my decision about the Supreme Court nomination. Just about 10 minutes into our talk, it was already clear to me that she had the best combinations of skills and instincts of any of those I was considering. I wanted to appoint someone who was open-minded, passionately committed to equality, and determined to work with the other judges to try to forge consensus when it was possible, and also willing to stand up for them when it wasn't. For more than 27 years on the Supreme Court, she went above and beyond even my highest expectations. So why am I telling you this? Because as we celebrate Women's History Month, Ruth Bader Ginsburg's remarkable story is an important reminder of the barriers she faced in her life and career. Systemic obstacles that her male counterparts were not subject to and often didn't even consider. She didn't just overcome those barriers. She tore many of them down and used her own experiences to inform her decades of work on behalf of others whose voices weren't being heard. Today, I want to share part of that story as told by Justice Ginsburg herself. In 2019, Justice Ginsburg joined NPR legal affairs correspondent Nita Totenberg for a special conversation hosted by the Clinton Presidential Center as part of the Compura's Distinguished Lecture Series. I often wonder if, as a young lawyer, she could have even imagined that the 86-year-old Supreme Court Justice version of herself would be filling arenas normally reserved for concerts and sports events, and acting as a role model for girls and boys who dreamed of living in a country dedicated to genuine fairness and equality. As you listen to this episode, I'd ask that you do so not just with a heavy heart that Justice Ginsburg is no longer with us, but with a sense of gratitude for the many years of wisdom, guidance, and inspiration she gave us. Her work made America stronger, fairer, more just, and we're all better because of her service.
Ladies and gentlemen, Justice Ginsburg and Nita Totenberg.
Thank you, thank you. Please, everyone, please be seated. Please be seated. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you all for coming. I think Justice Ginsburg and I have never, ever appeared before an audience this large before. I understand that normally this is, I guess recently, the worldwide wrestling entertainment. We are not going to wrestle each other. We're going to try to entertain you a bit and inform you. You've heard President Clinton describing why he picked Justice Ginsburg. But I think I should start this interview asking you about that interview. So let me set the stage. The year is 1993. The new president is flirting with all manner of potential Supreme Court nominations. And the names keep getting leaked to the likes of me. And behind the scenes, the inimitable Martin Ginsburg is doing everything in his power to promote his tiny but auspicious wife. And finally, you get a call from Bernie Nussbaum, the White House counsel, and it's a call that you had long hoped for, but you are in something of a fashion dilemma. So tell us about how you got the call that day calling you to the White House and what your fashion dilemma was.
I was called on a Saturday in Vermont, where I was to attend a wedding. And Bernie Nussbaum said, the president wants to meet you. Please come back to D.C. And I said, well, I've come all this way to attend the wedding. Can I come tomorrow morning? And he said, fine, we'll go right from the airport to the White House. And I said, but I'll be wearing my traveling clothes. Well, that's okay, because the president would be just coming off the golf course. So I arrive in my plain clothes, and in comes a very handsome president wearing his Sunday best because he'd just come from church.
So what was the conversation with the president like? What kinds of things did he ask? And did you have a good time, or were you in interview agony?
No, it was very easy to talk to the president. We talked about constitutional law. After all, he was a constitutional law professor. We talked about family. We talked about many things. And I've had the experience with some men that they have a certain discomfort talking to a woman. That was not that way with President Clinton.
So I was told after that interview by a number of White House aides that he just fell for you hook, line, and sinker. And this afternoon when we were talking, he said, in 5 minutes, I had just fallen for her hook, line, and sinker. But when did you get the word? Do I recall that you got a call from Bernie Nussbaum when you were in the bathtub or something like that night?
It was rather late on Sunday night. And it was one of the happiest moments of my life. I was absolutely on cloud nine. And then the president said, and tomorrow morning we will have a little ceremony in the Rose Garden, and we'd like you to make a few remarks. I had to come down from the cloud, sit at my writing table. I liked the remarks. It was the only time in that entire episode when there was no time for White House handlers to go over what I was going to say. So, my own words, unedited.
You know, you then went into a confirmation process. I think in the end you got, I'm not sure about this, I think there were only
96 to 3,
thank you. Republicans today often cite the Ginsburg rule. And when I go back and I read the transcript, I read about what your rule was. But it strikes me that in light of modern confirmation hearings, more modern confirmation hearings, nominees are considerably less responsive of all political stripes, not just Republican nominees. You actually answered questions about abortion and the death penalty and all kinds of things.
The Ginsburg rule was that you please do not ask a question that may come before the court, because then I would have to disqualify myself if I gave an answer, because a judge is not supposed to react just off the top of her head. When a question is presented to us, we read, first of all, the decisions that were written by the courts below, the trial court, Court of Appeals, and then we read the briefs that are anything but brief, filed by the lawyers, and we read the relevant precedent. So to give an answer to a question without the benefit of all that reading and briefing is not what a judge could do. Still, there was a lot out there that I could be asked about, because I was 17 years a law teacher, 13 years a judge on a court of appeals, so I'd written hundreds of opinions, many articles, and anything that I had already written was fair game.
So you arrive at the court, you're the second woman, and Justice O'Connor had been there for 12 long years without you, right? What advice did she give you?
She told me just enough to enable me to navigate those early weeks. She didn't douse me with a bucket full of information, just enough to get by. She was, I think, very pleased at a change the court made when I was appointed. Justice O'Connor was the lone woman on the court for 12 years. In our robing room, there is a bathroom, and it says men. For Justice O'Connor, when the need arose, she had to go all the way back to her chambers. When I came on board, they rushed a renovation. They created a women's bathroom equal in size to the men's.
Your first opinion assigned to you was not quite what you expected, and you went to her.
Yes. The legend is that the new justice, the junior justice, will get a single issue case in which the court is unanimous. Well, Chief Justice Rehnquist gave me as my first assignment a miserable ERISA case. ERISA is the Employee Retirement Security Act. It is one of the most complex statutes Congress ever wrote. The court was not unanimous. It divided 6-3, and Justice O'Connor was on the other side. She was one of the three. So I came to her and I said, Sandra, he was not supposed to do that to me. Her response, and this is typical of Justice O'Connor, she said, Ruth, you just do it. Just do it. And get your opinion draft in circulation before he makes the next set of assignments. Otherwise, you will risk getting another miserable case.
I could never understand why lawyers that appeared before the court, who appeared before the court, and not people who were not accustomed to the court, but some very seasoned lawyers, would get these two women mixed up. And Sandra Day O'Connor was about 5'7" or 5'8". You claim to be over 5 feet tall. She was a Western ranch girl with a Western twang. You were a New Yorker, a Brooklyn girl. I don't know that it was a Brooklyn twang, but you were clearly an Easterner. She didn't wear her hair the way you do. And still, people kept calling you Justice O'Connor and her Justice Ginsburg. Why?
Much more often, I was called Justice O'Connor. Well, The lawyers had learned there was a woman on the court, and her name was Justice O'Connor. So when they heard a woman's voice, it had to be Justice O'Connor. And she would sometimes respond, "I'm Justice O'Connor, she's Justice Ginsburg." There was a lot of attention paid to the two of us and how we interacted. And one day, I think it was in USA Today, there was a headline. The headline was, "Rude Ruth Interrupts Sandra." Sandra had asked a question, an argument. I thought she was finished. And she said, "Just a minute, I have follow-up questions." I apologized to her, and she said, "Ruth, don't give it another thought. The guys do it to each other all the time."
There even was a T-shirt presented to the two of you, I think, by, I think it was the Radcliffe, somebody, some group of women from Radcliffe, and one side said, "I'm Sandra, I'm Sandra, not Ruth."
It was the National Association of Women Judges. They had a reception for the two of us, and they gave her a T-shirt that said, "I'm Sandra, not Ruth, mine, I'm Ruth, not Sandra." But if we can fast forward, I can tell you that doesn't happen anymore now that we are three.
What kind of a difference does it make to have three?
One is the public perception. We have a line, a 10-minute line, often school children coming in and out of the court. And if they see three women, because of my seniority, I sit next to the chief. Justice Sotomayor is on one side, Justice Kagan on the other. So we're one third of the court, we're all over the bench. And as you will affirm, my sisters-in-law are not shrinking violets. They are very active in the colloquy that goes on at an oral argument. For the years Justice Scalia was with us, there was kind of a competition between Justice Sotomayor and Justice Scalia, which one could ask the most questions at an oral argument.
You were the lone woman justice after Justice O'Connor retired. From 2006, I think, to 2000, pretty near the end of 2009. And I had the sense that you were not a very happy camper at that time.
It was a lonely position. And viewing the court, there was something wrong with the picture. The public would see these eight rather well-fed men coming on the bench. And then there was this rather small woman.
And did you find that even there, on occasion, when you were just one, did you occasionally see that phenomenon of you say something and nothing happens, and then 10 minutes later or 5 minutes later, one of your brethren says the same thing and everybody goes, "Oh, that's a very good idea"?
Well, that happened at conference more than once. But I would make a comment, no reaction. Then one of my male colleagues would say basically the same thing, and people would react, "That's a good idea, let's discuss it." It's a habit that had developed that you don't expect very much from the woman, so you kind of tune out when she speaks, but you listen. when a male speaks. Now, I can tell you that that experience, which I had as a member of a law faculty, as a member of a court of appeals, now that I have two sisters in law, it doesn't happen.
I'm going to pause here and ask you the question on people's minds. You've had a lot of serious threats to your health this year. You were operated on for lung cancer in December. You have just completed 3 weeks of radiation treatment for an additional cancer. So, how are you feeling? And excuse me, I'm really thrilled that we're here, but why are we here? You finished radiation treatment at the end of August.
Yes, and August 23rd was the last session, but I had promised the Clinton Library that I would be here, and I just was not going to. Thank you, thank you. Thank you. And I'm pleased to say that I am feeling very good tonight.
Keep going. I mean, you have. I took a ton of briefs with me on the plane here, and I managed about an hour and a half's worth, and then I was ready for a break. You do this when you're sometimes feeling really rotten in the last year. How do you keep going?
I think my work is what saved me, because instead of dwelling on my physical discomforts, if I have an opinion to write or I have a brief to read, I know I've just got to get it done, and so I have to get over it. Well, this is another instance where I got very good advice from Justice O'Connor. Justice O'Connor had a mastectomy, and she was on the bench 9 days after her surgery. She told me in my first cancer bout was colorectal cancer, "Ruth, you schedule your chemotherapy for a Friday. Then you can get over it a Saturday and Sunday and be back in court on Monday."
But you have done this really all of your life. Cancer is not a stranger to you. Your mother died the day before your graduation. Your husband was diagnosed with testicular cancer when you were both at Harvard Law School. And you had an 18-month or 2-year-old child at the same time. And you're on Law Review. I think I often get Justice Ginsburg just to describe what a day in her life, that awful year, was like before Marty survived and beat the odds.
We took it day by day. We always believed that we would prevail, that we would beat the cancer. It was not an easy time. After he had surgery, he had massive radiation because there was no chemotherapy in those days. So he would come home, be sick, go to sleep, He'd get up about 12, midnight, and whatever he ate for the day, he would eat then. He would dictate his senior paper to me. I had note takers for all of his classes. My routine was I would go to my classes in the morning, go to the hospital in the afternoon, come home, play with my daughter, who was then two. No, Jane was three. Put her to bed. After dinner, which was at midnight, I would then go back to the books and prepare for the next day. So I was getting along on 2 hours of sleep a night for week on end. But we always had a positive attitude that we would live.
So for your last year of law school, because Marty was a year ahead of you, you moved to New York to be with him for his job. You graduated tied for first in your class at Columbia Law School, but you couldn't get a job. You and Justice O'Connor used to talk about how lucky that was,
yes,
in hindsight, that you couldn't get jobs when you graduated at the tops of your respective classes.
Well, that's an example of how something that may seem dreadful, very bad luck, turns out to be the most fortunate thing that ever happened to you. And Justice O'Connor put it this way. She said, suppose we had graduated from law school at a time when there was no discrimination, when women were welcome at the bar. What would we be today? We would be retired partners from some large law firm. But that route wasn't open to us, so we had to find another path, and that path led us to become Supreme Court justices.
You were recommended for all kinds of clerkships, Supreme Court clerkships, Court of Appeals clerkships. Nobody would interview you. None of these, because in those days they were all men, would interview you. You finally did get a clerkship back then, thanks to the rather assertive intervention of one of your professors, who basically said to your judge, the judge who hired you, if you take her and it doesn't work out, I have a guy who I'll send to you. He's at a law firm now. But if you don't, I will never send you another Columbia grad. So you went to work for Judge Palmieri. It ended up for 2 years, despite the fact that you had two strikes against you, where you were not only a woman, you were a mother. But one of the charming stories of this period of your life is that one of the judges who turned you down and was not interested in you was Judge Learned Hand, a very famous, famous judge. And he turned you down because he said he couldn't swear in front of you.
So
you pick up the story from there.
Judge Learned Hand lived one block away from the judge for whom I clerked, Judge Palmieri. And Judge Palmieri often drove Learned Hand home. When I was finished in time, I would ride uptown with them, sitting in the back seat. And this great jurist would say anything that came into his head. Words that my mother never taught me. And I asked him, you say you won't consider me as a clerk because you would have to censor your speech. And yet in this car, I don't seem to inhibit you at all. And his response was, young lady, I am not looking at you.
For those of you who have not seen RBG or the biopic On the Basis of Sex, I recommend both. They provide a pretty good view of your career prior to becoming a judge and then later a Supreme Court justice. But what used to strike me when I covered your arguments was how you had tailored your arguments. You had an all-male Supreme Court, and you tailored your gender discrimination cases, the arguments in those cases, to appeal to different justices in different ways. And you often had male plaintiffs, and one of those male plaintiffs was Steven Wiesenfeld, whose wife died in childbirth and who was denied Social Security benefits for his child who survived, even though his wife was the principal breadwinner. And you won, but there were basically three arguments that succeeded, and I wanted you to talk about how each group of justices saw it.
First, let me tell the audience how Steven Wiesenfeld came to my attention. He had written a letter to the editor to his local paper in Edison, New Jersey, and he said, I've been hearing a lot these days about women's lib. Let me tell you my story. My wife died of an embolism just after our son was born. And I knew that there were benefits available to a sole surviving parent who had a young child to take care of. So I went to the Social Security office to claim those benefits, and I was told, we're very sorry, Mr. Wiesenfeld, these are mother's benefits. They're not available to fathers. Now, it was obvious to me that although the plaintiff was a man, the discrimination was against the woman as wage earner. She paid the same Social Security taxes that a man would pay, but her contributions did not net for her family the same protection. So I think it was the dominant view of the court that this was really discrimination against the woman as wage earner. A few of the justices said, no, it's discrimination against the male as parent. He doesn't have the option to personally care for his child. Under Social Security, you could earn a certain amount and still get the Social Security benefits. If you earned over the limit, the benefits would be reduced dollar for dollar. And Wiesenfeld had figured out, I can do part-time work, earn a certain amount, and keep those benefits. So some of the justices said, it's obvious that it's discrimination against the male as parent. He has no choice but to work full-time. He doesn't have the option to care personally for his newborn. And then there was one who later became my chief, then Justice Rehnquist, who said, it's totally arbitrary from the point of view of the baby. Why should the baby have the opportunity for the care of a sole surviving parent only if that parent is female and not if the parent is male? So it was such a wonderful illustration of how gender-based discrimination hurts everyone, hurts women, hurts men, and children.
There was a case that you had that you wanted to take to the Supreme Court, but you couldn't because the case involving the, I think, Army or Air Force pregnant woman.
This is in Strzok case.
Yes.
Yes. I had hoped that that would be the first reproductive choice case that the court would hear. The case arose in 1971 when Captain Strzok was serving in the Air Force. And she was serving abroad when she became pregnant. Pregnancy in those days was a mandatory ground for discharge. The base commander said to her, 1971, 2 years before Roe v. Wade, "You can have an abortion on base. We provide those for women in service and wives of men in service. And if you do, you can remain in the Air Force. But if you choose to go through the pregnancy, you are discharged. No exceptions." Susan Strzok said, "I'm a Roman Catholic. I cannot have an abortion, but I've made arrangements to have the child adopted at birth. I will cost the taxpayers nothing because I'll use only my accumulated leave time for the birth." And she said, "You know, here we are at Kroc Air Force Base, where some of my male colleagues get hooked on alcohol or on drugs, and you don't mandate their discharge. If they report themselves, they can be in a rehabilitation program, and you will keep them for much longer than the time I'm going to take off for this birth. Doesn't make any sense. Pregnancy is a ground, a mandatory ground for discharge, and that was that." Susan Strzok brought her case in a federal district court. She lost there. Oh, by the way, she was very well represented, so she got a stay of her discharge every month. So she was always in, fighting to stay in, not out, trying to get back in. Anyway, what happened, then it went to the Court of Appeals. She lost again, but there was a very good dissenting opinion. And then I wrote a petition to the Supreme Court to hear her case. The Supreme Court said, "Yes, we'll take it." And then the Solicitor General at the time, who had been dean of the law school I first attended, he asked to have a meeting with the top military people and said, "This case has lost potential for the government. You should waive Captain Strzok's discharge and then change the rule prospectively so that pregnancy is no longer an automatic discharge." And the Air Force did. And then immediately the government moved to have the case returned to the Court of Appeals for determination whether it was moot, no longer live, because she got all the relief she was seeking. She remained an Air Force officer. So I called Captain Strzok and said, "Is there anything you're missing so that we can claim this case is still alive?" And she said, "Well, I have all my pay and allowances, so nothing there, but there is one thing." And this conversation is going on now in 1972. She said, "All my life, I've dreamed of becoming a pilot. but the Air Force doesn't give flight training to women. And then we laughed because we knew in 1972 was much too early. It was still an impossible dream to win that case. And the difference between then and now is one of the reasons why I am optimistic about the future. Today, it would be unthinkable to deny flight training to women.
Justice Ginsburg, this may be a little too thinky, but I think it's important to talk about. And that is the notion of originalism versus a living constitution. A majority of the current court believes, to one degree or another, in the notion that justices should interpret the Constitution as it was meant by the founding fathers when it was written in the late 1700s, that the original intent is what matters, and the text as it was written and what it was intended. You and most of the justices you have served with, at least until now, have a somewhat different take, that the Constitution was written to be elastic enough, as Justice Kennedy, now retired, put it, to accommodate changes in society. Could you talk about your thinking a bit?
President Clinton said it so well in his introduction. Our Constitution begins with the words, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union." So think how things were in 1787. Who were we, the people? Certainly not people who were held in human bondage, because the original Constitution preserved slavery. And certainly not women, whatever their color. And not even men who own no property. So it was a rather elite group, we the people. But I think the genius of our Constitution is what Justice Thurgood Marshall said. He said he doesn't celebrate the original Constitution, but he does celebrate what the Constitution has become now over two centuries. And that is, the concept of we the people has become ever more inclusive. So people who were left out at the beginning, slaves, women, men without property, Native Americans were not part of we the people. Now all the once left out people are part of our political constituency. And we are certainly a more perfect union as a result of that. The Constitution, the original Constitution, preserved the slave trade till 1808. One of the provisions that's an embarrassment is the Fugitive Slave Clause. It said, if someone held as a slave escapes into a free state and the master asks to get the slave back, the slave must be returned to the master. That Fugitive Slave Clause is in Article 4 of the Constitution, where you can still read it today, but there'll be a star next to it saying, changed by the 14th Amendment, which says,
you know, when I, the first time I met Justice Ginsburg, it was by phone, and we were both quite young women, compared to now anyway. And I was a brand new Supreme Court reporter reading about the first case claiming that discrimination against women was a violation of the 14th Amendment, the first case in the Supreme Court. It was ultimately the case that the court first said it was a violation of the 14th Amendment. And I didn't understand it. And I, because I said, you know, the 14th Amendment was enacted to cover slaves and African Americans, and doesn't say anything about women. And I called you up, and you gave me an hour-long lecture, but I'm going to ask you for a 60-second version.
But you said, I thought the 14th Amendment was about race.
Yes.
And I said, yes, it certainly is about race. But the 14th Amendment reads, nor shall any state deny to any person the equal protection of the laws. No, the first time the Supreme Court heard such an argument was in the 1870s. a woman wanted to vote, and she said she was stopped at the polls, and she said, now I read the Constitution, and it says, nor shall any state deny to any person the equal protection of the laws. The court's response to her was, you are indeed a person, and you are a citizen of the United States, but so too are children. And no one would suggest that children should have the right to vote. The court has come a long way since then. The turning point case that you asked me about was called Reed v. Reed, and it was about Sally Reed, who had a great tragedy in her life. She had a son. She and her husband divorced. When the boy was young, the legal term is of tender years, Sally was appointed custodian of the child. When the boy reached his teens, the father went to the family court and said, now he needs to be prepared for a man's world, so I should be the custodian. Sally fought that. She thought it was would not be good for her son to live in his father's home. But she lost. Sadly, she turned out to be right. The boy was sorely depressed. And one day he took out one of his father's many guns and committed suicide. So Sally wanted to be appointed administrator of his estate to take care of whatever he left behind, which was precious little, small bank account, a guitar, some records, that was about it. And she applied. Her former husband applied 2 weeks later. And the probate court judge said to Sally, I'm sorry, but the law gives me no choice. It reads, this was the law of the state of Idaho, as between persons equally entitled to administer a decedent's estate, equally entitled, males must be preferred to females. And the thing about Sally Reed is she was an everyday woman. She made her living by caring for elderly or disabled people in her home. But she thought an injustice had been done to her. And she also believed that our legal system would right that wrong. So on her own dime, she took the case through three levels of the Idaho courts And then I got involved in the case and wrote the brief for her Supreme Court case. She prevailed with a unanimous decision. It was the first time, the case was decided in November 1971, first time in history that the Supreme Court ever held a gender-based classification unconstitutional. And then after that 1971 precedent, we were on a roll. Case after case, challenging gender-based classifications.
And you can see on the basis of sex and understand more, and RBG and understand yet more. So speaking of children for a moment, I want to sort of lighten this up before I close with some conversation about your late great friend Justice Scalia and your relationship with him. But first, could I get you to tell the story of the elevator thief?
Oh, the elevator thief was my then, let's see, how old was James E.? Must have been 11, my son. My son was a lively child. I called him lively, but his teachers called him hyperactive. His school had a hand-operated elevator. The elevator operator went out to smoke a cigarette, and one of my son's classmates dared him to take the kindergartners from the ground floor up to the top floor. So my son did that, and he was greeted by three stone faces, the room teacher, the school principal, and the school psychologist. And I was called, I was getting calls about once a month, to come down to the school to hear about my son's latest escapade. Well, one day I was in my office at Columbia Law School and feeling particularly weary because I'd stayed up all night writing a brief. And I said to the caller, "This child has two parents. Please alternate calls." And it's his father's turn. So, and Marty, my husband, went down to the school and was told, "Your son stole the elevator." And my husband, who had a wonderful sense of humor, said, "So he stole the elevator. How far could he take it?" Now, I don't know if it was Marty's sense of humor. I suspect it was that the school was very hesitant to take a man away from his work. There was no quick change in my son's behavior, but the calls came barely once a term because they had to think twice before calling a man away from his work.
You and the late Justice Scalia used to spar incessantly about the whole subject of originalism versus a living constitution and textualism. But you were great friends for many decades. You served on the same Court of Appeals. You'd known each other even, I think, at the University of Chicago briefly. So let me start with that personal friendship. People seem always so surprised that Justice Scalia, this iconic conservative, and Justice Ginsburg, this iconic feminist, were such good friends. So, and I know that you really loved him. So what did you love about him?
He had a marvelous sense of humor. When we were on the Court of Appeals together, the Court of Appeals has three judges, and he would sit next to me, and he'd whisper something during the argument that absolutely cracked me up, and I had all I could do to avoid bursting out into hysterical laughter. One thing that we had in common, both worked very hard on our opinions. We tried to write them so at least judges and other lawyers and hopefully a larger public could understand what we were saying. Justice Scalia was the son of a Latin professor at Brooklyn College, and his mother was a grade school teacher, so he was an expert grammarian. He would sometimes come to my chambers or call me and say, "Ruth, you made a grammatical error. I don't want to embarrass you by sending you a note that would be circulated to all of our colleagues, but you should fix this up." And I would call him and say, "You know, this opinion is so strident, you're not going to be as persuasive as you would be if you would tone it down." He never took that advice. We also really cared about family. We spent every New Year's together, and the two couples, plus as many, he had many more children than I did, but whatever children wanted to come along. And Justice Scalia and I shared a passion for opera. So we were supers, extras, in a couple of opera performances at the Washington National Opera.
Am I making this up, or did you sit on his lap in one of those?
No, the soprano sat on his lap. So he knew that she was going to end the song on his lap, but what he didn't know is that she was going to throw her arms around him and give him a big kiss.
And you travel together. There's a very funny picture in your chambers of the two of you on an...
We travel to India for a judicial exchange, and the two of us broke away from the pack for a couple of days, and we went to Rajasthan and to Agra. And there was a famous picture where in the Rambagh Palace in Rajasthan, a very beautiful, it was the palace of the last Maharaja of Rajasthan. So there was a very elegant elephant, very beautifully painted elephant. And we were taking a ride on the elephant, and I'm sitting in the back, and Scalia is in the front, and my feminist friend said, "Horace, what are you doing sitting in the back of the elephant?" And I explained it had to do with the distribution of weight. There is an opera, as you would expect, a comic opera about the two of us. It's called Scalia Ginsburg. Again, why is Scalia first? Because in our workplace, seniority really counts, and he was appointed some years before I was. So the opera tries to portray the difference between us, and Scalia's opening aria is a rage aria. It goes like this. "The justices are blind. How can they possibly spout this? The Constitution says absolutely nothing about this." And then I answer, "Dear Justice Scalia."
Oh, but you come in through a glass ceiling.
Oh, that's later.
Oh, that's later?
Sorry.
I screwed up the story.
This is the beginning. We set up the different ways we approach a legal text. I said, "You're searching for a bright line solution to problems that don't have easy answers. But the great thing about our Constitution is that, like our society, it can evolve. And then there's kind of a jazz riff with let it grow, let it grow. The plot is roughly based on the magic flute. Justice Scalia is locked in a dark room. He is being punished for excessive dissenting. And that's when I enter through a glass ceiling to help him pass the tests he needs to pass to get out of the dark room. Then a character called the Commentatore, who is borrowed from Don Giovanni, is appalled. He said, why would you want to help him? He's your enemy. And I explained, he's not my enemy. He's my dear friend. And then we sing a wonderful duet. It's titled, We Are Different, We Are One. Different in our approach to reading a legal text, but one in our reverence for the Constitution and for the institution we serve.
Well, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, dear notorious one, we thank you for a wonderful evening.
Why Am I Telling You This is a production of iHeartRadio, the Clinton Foundation, and At Will Media. Our executive producers are Craig Manassian and Will Malnati. Our production team includes Mitch Bluestein, Jameson Katsoufis, Tom Galton, Sarah Horowitz, and Jake Young, with production support from Tyler Scott and Latavia Young. Original music by Watt White. Special thanks to John Sykes, Tina Flannoy, John Davidson, Angel Urena, Corey Gansley, Oscar Flores, Kevin Thurm, and all our dedicated staff and partners at the Clinton Foundation. If you have an idea or suggestion for the show, we'd love to hear from you. So please visit clintonfoundation.org/podcast to share your thoughts with us. If you like the show, tell someone else about it. You can subscribe to Why Am I Telling You This on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast. By listening to this podcast, you're helping support the work of the Clinton Foundation. So thank you.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Street, Executive Director of the Clinton Foundation, where we work every single day to advance President Clinton's commitment to public service and improve lives across the country and around the world. President Clinton often reminds us that we're all in this together, that we rise or fall together. That's why, in the face of crisis, we answer the call. We act. At the Clinton Presidential Center, we've been proud to work together with partners to serve hundreds of thousands of meals to those struggling to put food on the table, to get books, early learning, and educational resources into the hands of parents, families, and educators who are navigating the realities of remote learning and need it most. And the center continues to serve as an educational and cultural institution focused on cultivating the next generation of leaders to make our future brighter than ever. Learn more about this work and see how you can get involved. Visit www.clintonfoundation.org/podcast.